Hello and welcome to the International Trade Resource Podcast, your go-to source for insights and information on all aspects of international trade. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a trade professional, or just curious about the global marketplace, we've got you covered. From customs regulations to export strategies, from emerging markets to international finance, we explore the latest trends and best practices that drive global commerce. Our host, Kim Kirkendall, sits down with a diverse range of experts who navigate the complex world of international trade and help you stay ahead of the game. So get ready to learn about the ins and outs of international trade on the International Trade Resource Podcast.
Hello, listeners. We've got a great dual podcast recording going for you here today. This is Kim Kirkendall with International Trade Resources Podcast, and I'm chatting today with Art Dicker. Art, do you want to tell us a little bit about your podcast?
Sure. Thanks, Kim. Yeah, it's fun. We've done podcasts before together, and I'm a senior counsel at R&P China Lawyers, and I host also a podcast, as you mentioned, called Asia Business Podcast. For the longest time, it was known as Ganbei. We've rebranded it a bit, Asia Business Podcast, and looking forward to the show.
Yeah, it's great. You've interviewed me for your podcast. I've interviewed you for mine. And now we get to chat.
We can't get enough of each other on a podcasting.
We can't. Well, it's good. It's good to be friends and in the same, you know, same space, right? Similar fields. So what we really started, listeners, how we came to this event is we started talking about how, you know, many companies are shifting manufacturing to Southeast Asia, and how there's kind of a lack of understanding for, you know, foreign companies about what are some of the same challenges and problems when dealing with in other Southeast Asian countries, what are some of the benefits. So I, you know, had suggested starting off kind of on the supplier, so the, you know, outside manufacturing side. We're also going to chat a bit, if we have the time, about, you know, when it's a subsidiary. But one of my, like Art and I, we agree on a lot of things. And one of the things we agree on is that it's very important to qualify your supplier. And, you know, it's become common practice for companies that have suppliers in China. And I find that they are struggling a little bit with how to do that when the suppliers in Thailand, you know, or Vietnam or somewhere else in Southeast Asia. Do you want to speak to that for a minute, Art?
Yeah, sure. You know, due diligence is always a bit of a challenge. It's, like you said, as we know in China, that's always a challenge and becoming more and more of a challenge. And I think in Southeast Asia, that's true as well. There's sort of the basic kind of information that you try to get anywhere. You can try and do, if it's a company, you can try and do litigation searches, bankruptcy searches. You can also, of course, try and do field visits and reputation checks with clients and other suppliers for that company, partners that they work with. If for the individuals involved, you can try and look for criminal records and confirming educational backgrounds, even and looking at beneficial ownership records, et cetera, et cetera. This stuff is generally available in some countries, less so in others there. I mean, I know in Indonesia, for example, it's relatively easy to do beneficial ownership search and get this other kind of information. You know, for countries like Malaysia, it's generally similar. You know, maybe like on the litigation side, it's a bit harder to do a search. There's no kind of comprehensive database. And then you get to countries like Vietnam, where it gets substantially more limited, a bit more like China in the earlier days. And you know, it goes kind of, the list goes on and on. It varies from country to country. A lot of it depends on kind of the development stage. And so it's never going to leave you in a position where you're completely relaxed about all the due diligence you can do. It might not be what you're used to being able to get, but
at least you shouldn't be relaxed.
Yeah, I shouldn't be relaxed. So, but there is in pretty much all the major markets there is at least some limited amount of due diligence you can do, but again, never quite enough.
There's so much media coverage in the US about China and concerns about China and the political conflicts with China that when I'm lecturing to industry groups or organizations in the US, I'll say to them, tell me about Thailand. Tell me about Vietnam. And they really can't tell me anything. You know, they really have no kind of ballpark knowledge about the political system or how the government operates, what the level of fraud and graft are in that country, you know, how safe it is. And I was just in Bangkok last week, and I can't tell you how many people said to me, are you safe? You know, you need to be careful. And people that used to go there for business 15, 20 years ago don't anymore. You know, there's been a new king. They're taking that much more seriously, that you can't say anything negative about the king or the monarchy. The military has been in charge, kind of behind the scenes. Now there's no behind the scenes anymore. And Vietnam recently had a big, you know, in the papers, a Vietnamese bank has been, the owner of the bank has been very quick trial, you know, very quickly found guilty in a situation where it's very common in Vietnam to have that kind of wealthy individual that owns a bank and uses the bank to finance their own businesses. So why they chose this person, I don't know. But long story short, listeners, you need to don't assume that just because it doesn't come to mind what the challenges and political and safety regulatory issues are in that country doesn't mean there aren't any. And then secondly, from a sourcing supplier management standpoint, you know, you need to do your due diligence, you know, the normal supplier qualification, you know, going into the factory, what is their quality management system? What is their purchasing system? What does their production line look like? Management, what's management's background? How are they running the factory? And Art mentioned having various types of ownerships. And historically, Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia had a tremendous amount of their economic wealth was held by ethnic Chinese who had emigrated there 40, 50, 100 years ago. And now you have a whole nother wave of Chinese coming in and investing in those companies. And again, it's not a bad thing. We're not saying it's a bad thing, but you want to see what's the background of the owner? How long have they owned the business? Do they have other companies in other countries? Are they shifting product from one country to another and potentially skirting the rules of country of origin? You know, that it's really being more manufactured in China than Vietnam. You want to be careful with all of those things. And that kind of leads us to the next topic that we both love to talk about, which is supplier agreements. One way to manage your risk in these situations is to have a really strong supplier agreement. You know, we've worked on those together before. Art, why don't you take that and tell us a little bit about, you know, what you think some of the keys are to a strong supplier agreement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and what the keys to the strong supplier agreement in Southeast Asia will be similar to things we've talked about before on our various podcasts about you know, for China. You know, I think one of the things that I often say gets lost, or probably the most critical thing, which is usually an afterthought, you know, if you're in the US or other jurisdictions, is the sort of the choice of law and jurisdiction question. So a lot of, as you know, Kim, a lot of people like US companies like to put US, you know, have the agreement governed by US law and have it, you know, dispute resolution in California or Texas or something like that. And the reality is, just like in China, when you're in Southeast Asia, you know, the enforcement of that, it's great. It's comfortable. It's familiar to you. But when you actually have to enforce your supplier agreement in country against in-country assets of the supplier, assuming they don't have a lot of assets outside of country, then you have to consider to what extent is the host country of the supplier actually honor an agreement that's, or more like, more specifically, a judgment that's been brought and won outside of the country when you're trying to enforce it in country. And so that is the problem with China, of course, that China does not recognize judgments from the U.S., pretty much full stop. And that's been a long historical problem we've dealt with on the legal side and had to counsel our clients about. And that carries over to Southeast Asia a bit as well. So if you look at Indonesia, for example, foreign judgments are basically not enforced. You basically have to have the whole matter relitigated. Compared to arbitration awards, which arbitration awards are fall under the New York Convention, and most countries around the world, including in Southeast Asia, are parties to the New York Convention on enforcement of arbitration awards. Even there, still, you have, again, just like China, you have cases where, in theory, the signatory country, China or Indonesia or wherever, is supposed to honor the foreign arbitration award, let's say it's in the US or somewhere else, and enforce that arbitration award locally. But these things often break down in practice or such a long delay. And many countries in Southeast Asia are just like that, like they are in China, signatories, but the enforcement tends to break down a bit.
One of the things I'd play off of what you're saying for listeners is mediation. Like it's not common, or it's much less common in the US. I think it's a bit more common in Europe and, some other markets to default disputes to mediation, arbitration, rather than the court system. In the US, they typically, it's all about taking it to the court system. So I would highlight for listeners what Art mentioned, that you need to look at what's the norm in that country. Does it go to mediation? Does it go to arbitration? Who are the arbitration bodies that it typically goes to? And I would also add language, because many times people bring me contracts to review, like from a commercial perspective. I am a CPA and I'm a supply chain operations person, so I do look at a lot of contracts. But those contracts are English only. That's just such a huge mistake. And many times, because it also doesn't have, if it only has the English translated name of that company and their address, and it doesn't have their identifying information, their ID number, that English name of that company in Malaysia or Vietnam is not their legal name, right? Their legal name is their name in their local language. So the contract should, and then if it goes to any kind of dispute arbitration or legal situation in that country, they're going to require someone to interpret what a contract meant in English, which is a bad idea. You want to control that by managing the translation of it into that local language. So I would definitely also, add to Art's good advice here, that you want to make sure that you understand the legal framework of that country, that you're much more likely to be able to enforce the agreement or collect on the agreement if it's arbitrated or litigated in that country, because that's where the business is happening, and that's where your partner's based. And then thirdly, I would add on this topic, because I had 4 calls last week with, smallish companies that were saying, the one company was saying to me, we have agreements with our agent and our supplier. And I said, you have an NDA. That is not what you need. I mean, that's fantastic, but and so many people, they have a close relationship with their intellectual property lawyer when they're designing new products or they're getting the products that they have patented. They often start their business on the back of a particular design or product, and then they grow that company over time. And that IP lawyer is not the person, no offense, IP lawyer friends out there, is not the person to be writing every or even recognizing all of the types of contracts that you might need in a particular commercial situation, or writing and creating those contracts for you if they don't have experience in that field, in that space, with trade, with licensing, with whatever it is, you know, and I have more customers than clients than I can shake a stick at that have an NDA agreement with factories overseas, and they build up a $150 million company on the back of product that they've designed using that supplier's technology. And the Americans or the client overseas thinks, I own it. I own the design. How do you own the design? It was originally their design and their technology, and they've made all the upgrades and changes. You couldn't even take it somewhere else and have it made because you don't understand how to make it. So how do you think you own it, the design, right?
I would just add one little point to that. Often the default in these developing or still kind of almost developed countries, however, whatever standard we want to put on it, China, again, is an example we're both very familiar with. When by default for technology that's imported into the country, the importer, the supplier that you're working with that's using the technology owns the improvements. You know, if nothing else is stated anywhere else in the contract, which goes directly to your point about an NDA being a very incomplete form for this kind of cooperation, then by default, the supplier will own those improvements. So you have to be very, very careful with that, because the starting point is already working against you. You have to be proactive in your contract to make that clear.
And I feel like I see this over and over and over again. So it's really, it's clearly one of those areas that people are just blind to. Like, you know, all too many times, just blind to. All right, we want to hit some key topics here. And one of the other ones that I think is really important is payments. You know, it's people that are used to dealing with China are used to how hard it's not hard to pay China, right? You can get your money into China. It's hard to get your money out of China. But even, and that can affect you as a importer of goods from China, because you may need they may want to refund your money. You may have a shipment that's defective. You may be, they may be buying tooling back from you that you're shipping over to them that you have in your plant in the United States or in Europe. So payments can go both ways. And again, you really need to do your due diligence on what is the banking and payment environment in that country. Because in many Southeast Asian countries, the banks are also government owned, just like they are in China. There's foreign exchange controls, just like it is in China. There's VAT, which has a tremendous effect on payments, the value-added tax, because you can lose your VAT rebates if payment's not made in time. It makes refunds of payments that you've already made harder. So, you know, there's a lot of the same challenges that you have in China you're going to find in many of these other Southeast Asian countries. Do you want to add to that, Art?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I would say it really varies country by country. Some are maybe much more familiar with what we're used to in the U.S., so kind of a relatively open capital account. See that a bit more like in Indonesia and Malaysia, bit in Thailand versus Vietnam, which is almost carbon copy what you and I have experienced in China. You know, currency controls, the peg or floating peg to that the government manages. Needing to do a full audit to get kind of a one-time window to make dividends out, and make sure you have to be profitable in order to do that. It's almost literally carbon copy of what we kind of bang our heads against the wall dealing with our clients in China, trying to get money out. So I think it really varies country by country, and some the China experience for our clients will be good in dealing with, you know, as they're shifting production or shifting to different markets like Vietnam. Some of these things, they'll recognize the difficulties of getting money in and out. And it just depends on each country. Vietnam will be very familiar to people dealing with having dealt with China before.
Not in a great way.
Yeah.
So we started this talking mostly about suppliers, and let's pivot a little bit to things that might affect you if you are thinking about setting up a subsidiary in Southeast Asia, if you already have a subsidiary in Southeast Asia. And one of those topics, Art, I know is close to your heart. And this applies whether it's suppliers, third-party suppliers, or your own subsidiary, protecting your intellectual property, you know, when it's being manufactured or viewed or used or sold even in another country. So I'll let you take off on that topic. What can you share with us about protecting intellectual property in Southeast Asia?
So with intellectual property, you know, generally your best practice that you take globally will apply here as well. I mean, there's sort of the registration part of it, which is relatively standard how you do country to country. Patents, it's generally you're always going to want your patents filed in your biggest markets, in the markets where you have the most to lose, essentially. And then on trademarks, you know, for these local countries, it's relatively cheap and inexpensive to do the filings. You got to be proactive about it. They're all first to file countries, generally, like China, not like the US. So you need to be wary that someone else is filing marks similar or exactly the same as yours, trying to get kind of get those marks registered and use them in country or for exports and so forth. Careful that your suppliers don't do that too proactively for you in their own name and say, "Don't worry, we got it for you." There's obviously a lot of issues down the road with that potentially if you have problems with them. And on the kind of the non-registration part, you know, it's just best practice. How are you sharing IP really much more on a need to know basis, right? Both within your own employees that you might have in country or people that you're working with in country with on the supplier side. And then as you've seen, Kim, you know, are you seeing sort of production overruns? Are you doing your own search in the market for counterfeits of your products, both coming out of the countries, in the country, you know, sort of stuff that fell off the truck, proverb, as we say. And so you're just, a lot of it, I'm sure the listeners here will be familiar from other jurisdictions, other countries. The same best practices apply here for kind of limiting as much as possible actual physical and or online kind of access to your IP as possible is always the best and first and best defense. And then the registration is on top of that.
And I think one of the things you mentioned in the beginning, you know, so many companies think, you know, I don't need to go through those steps because I don't intend to sell in Cambodia or Indonesia. I'm only manufacturing there. So I don't need to register my intellectual property there. And that's such a mistake, because just because you don't think today that you're not going to do that doesn't mean that you won't 5 or 10 years from now. And it also doesn't mean that your manufacturing partner doesn't think they can, right? Or someone else doesn't think they can. So just because you don't think you're selling in that market is not a good reason not to protect your IP in that market, right? I would just call that out because I've seen way too many of those scenarios. And then as you mentioned, the practical methods of, you know, can you separate components, key components in different factories, and then move them, you know, move those components elsewhere for assembly? Your secret sauce, whatever your secret sauce is, if that's software or a particular raw material or how a material is treated, you know, heated and cooled and heated and whatever processes you go through, can you keep that somewhere away from, you know, in another plant and in your own plant somewhere else? You know, how can you do that? And then one of my favorite methods for protecting your intellectual property is to be a really good partner. You know, it's if they're going to make more money with you than they're going to make against you, why would they screw it up, right? Why would they threaten that business relationship? So we often see companies competing against previous customers when there's been a problem in the relationship, when the business has gone down or they've walked away from that factory. And I've seen those, I'm sure you've seen those, when they think, oh, we're going to pull out of this factory and we're going to do it in a really abrupt, harsh, you know, screw you, we're leaving kind of way. And I'm like, do you really want to set somebody up, you know, with that much motivation to knock you off? Because that's what you're doing. So being a good partner, being thoughtful about how you exit the business. One other thing I do with a lot of companies is we don't, if you're manufacturing in multiple locations in multiple countries, you don't, if there's a particular country or partner or environment you're uncomfortable with, they don't get your highest technology product, right? You have them making your lower tech product that is not, you know, your most recent critical intellectual property, and you're manufacturing that in another country or environment that you feel you have more control over, right? That's another like really good strategy. One of the other things that's becoming a huge issue in China is compliance. There's always been compliance requirements. If your product is regulated by, you know, the Food and Drug Administration in whatever country you're selling into, electrical products, children's toys, automotive, you know, medical devices, like those things are always regulated, but we're seeing more trade related compliance, right? That is meant to discourage trade, and more tax tariff issues. And again, we're seeing those in China. Don't go into other Southeast Asian countries thinking, number one, I'm not going to have to be equally careful when I'm here because there's not an antagonistic relationship right now, because there might be. Also, the people that you're dealing with in those countries may be buying components or raw materials from China, and therefore the product is still part of that regulatory landscape, even though the final assembly or production is being done in another Southeast Asian country. So don't underestimate the ongoing requirements, the cost of compliance in all of those areas. And, you know, make sure you understand what the country you're importing into, what do they have in place for the country that you're buying from, right? Don't assume, again, just because it's not China, that it's not difficult.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. I mean, I think similar to what we all experienced with China, you know, 15 years ago or so, you know, let's look at, for example, labor law compliance, right? You kind of mentioned the people for the longest time were used to China being a relatively, easy place to do business as far as the labor laws were concerned, right? And that quickly changed in around 2008 with the labor contract law that came in and really flipped it, where it was much more, even more European style as far as the protections for of employee rights and so forth. And I think we see quite a few laws on the books throughout Southeast Asia, which are not quite as favorable to employees and compliance as China is with that labor contract law. For example, you know, you still need to be aware of the rules there, because the point is you don't know when these things will kind of percolate up and come back to bite you. Maybe there's other reasons that the partner that you're working with or some other situation when you're in, and suddenly these laws, which maybe were more of an afterthought, like you said, because they're always there kind of sitting, waiting to be a compliance problem for you.
That's a great one area to call out is labor issues and, you know, labor laws. When I was in Bangkok, I happened to be sitting next to a U.S. embassy person from Bangladesh. And their role at the U.S. embassy in Bangladesh is to go into factories and check to see if they're compliant. There's no child labor, there's no forced labor. Bangladesh is a whole lot of wild, wild west, you know, a whole lot of wild, wild west. So, but don't assume that you aren't going to have a lot of those same issues in Thailand. You know, Thailand, I was just in Thailand, so it's kind of top of mind for me, but there's a lot of foreign workers in Thailand. They've been a developed, you know, more industrialized, bigger middle class country for, you know, a number of years now, for decades now. And so they're really relying on foreign labor. And, you know, is there forced labor in there? Is there gangs and gang problems in Thailand, Vietnam? You know, you've got the North, you know, the government in the North and the kind of the wild, wild west business side in the south of Vietnam that is not as rule following. They're right next to Cambodia and Laos, where are still very early developing industrialization countries. There's a lot of available workforce, you know, coming from those areas into Vietnam. The borders are a little more porous than they are in some other countries. So, you know, you really want to make sure, and not just the regulations, but also from a branding standpoint and a PR standpoint, how are you presenting yourself to the market? And do you really want to be involved with suppliers that are using child labor, forced labor, you know, any of those kind of things? So you definitely want to be careful. I'm glad you brought that part up. I think we're getting a little close to our like average 30 minutes here. We've got a couple other things we could cover here in terms of subsidiaries, one of them being corporate dividends, you know, getting funds that you've invested in that country out of that country. Do you want to touch on that one for a bit?
Sure. Yeah, I think.
Or setting up a company, because that's kind of part of it too.
Yeah, on the setting up of a company part, it also varies quite a bit region to region. As probably many of the listeners know, setting up a company in China is easier than it was before. Still not necessarily easy, which with what you're used to in let's say, you know, the US, UK, Singapore, even. But you know, and there's variation, right? So. If you're talking about Malaysia, it's kind of a UK kind of based system. It's relatively developed. It's a bit easier, a bit closer to, let's say, Singapore or something like that. If you're talking about Vietnam, it's much more like China. You're setting up essentially a WFOE. You need old school stuff that we don't even see much in China anymore. You need like a feasibility study report, all this kind of stuff. You need a resident director potentially from in country. Other places like Indonesia, the capital requirements are relatively higher for getting the company set up. You can also see things that are similar to China on kind of like in foreign investment catalog. Certain industries are open. In Indonesia, they have a kind of this risk-based system of categorizing different industries. Again, similar to China, the internet industry in theory is open to foreign investment, but it's considered high risk. Can you actually get that kind of a business set up there for such a big market as a foreign company? I've heard plenty of stories where the local companies have so much more of an advantage. And again, it's very similar to China, both from just an operating style and also from the regulations generally are more protective of local companies in these sectors. So company setup is always going to be a bit more challenging in these countries than what you're probably used to in your home country.
You also want to, I would add, you want to look and see, there's sometimes requirements about, you mentioned, you know, corporate governance, that you have to have a local corporate officer. Sometimes you have to have a certain number of local employees, mm-hmm. you know, or even some local shareholders, right, of the business. So you need to really be looking into that country, and it can change, not only with, it can change country to country, but within a country, it can change by industry. Certain industries have more requirements for setting up than others, in terms of restriction on ownership. And some of these countries are countries that you might be thinking, oh, I've heard it's easy. You know, that's great talk in the locker room, but do your due diligence first. Don't go off of, you know, Bob said they set it up last year and it wasn't hard, because it doesn't always work out that way. Right. What other, like in terms of this, so there's the whole incorporation side. I would also caution people, it's often much harder to close a company in many countries than it is in the US or Europe. So, you know, closing a company in China is notoriously expensive and difficult. I've done quite a few. I'm sure you've done quite a few.
Yeah.
So don't assume that. So don't go lightly into setting up a company, right? Because closing it isn't easy. So don't make that mistake. And then in terms of your investment capital and getting that investment capital out of the country, what tips can you share with us, Art?
Yeah, I mean, we touched on it a bit earlier, you know, the whole, in China, of course, the main ways to get money out are through a commercial contract, right, where you take that to your bank and say, look, I have a payment to make, to the parent company, right, for a service contract, you know, intra-group service contract, so forth. And if it's a dividend, again, it's a one-time annual opportunity you have after completion of an audit. And as I mentioned, in Vietnam, that's a very similar setup. Other countries will not necessarily have as strict legal formalities that you have, hoops that you have to jump through like that with your bank even. But you still have, you know, if you're dividending money out, you still have to, in theory, need to be a profitable business to do that. That's pretty much a standard rule anywhere you operate. So that's always a challenge. And again, country to country, it varies a bit, Vietnam being probably the hardest. But if our listeners are familiar with the experience of China, it will be familiar, even though it will be painful. It will be a familiar pain, I guess, is what we can say. But yeah, you need to plan this. All the thing is, you just need to plan this out well in advance, because this process takes time.
And I would reinforce that with saying, when you're setting up the company, you need to figure out how you're going to plan on getting your money back out, like in profits, in expenses that might need to be repaid from the subsidiary to the parent. That is at the point that you should be deciding how you're going to do this when you're setting up the company, not 3 years later when it's profitable, right? So start planning for it very early on. All right. Any one last thing we want to share with our listeners here?
Yeah. One last little point, just because I'm based here in the US now, and it's an issue that just keeps coming up here, being, especially every time I visit my friends in Washington, DC, is the whole compliance with a lot of the US regulations that affect trade and forced labor and all that kind of stuff. You know, in China, we have there's this law in the US called the Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act for dealing with cotton and stuff coming from Xinjiang. And a lot of companies, as you know, Kim, have moved production away from China because of that regulations and other regulations to Malaysia, Vietnam, and so forth. And they just to point out, and I'm sure our listeners that are contemplating doing that are already familiar with this, but they should, that the US government is also on the lookout specifically for these countries, like Malaysia and Vietnam have been explicitly flagged by customs as countries where they know people are doing what we call a transshipments, right? You hit it on the top, where the production is coming from China, there's maybe some limited modifications in those countries, and then it's re-exported. But the government, particularly on this law, is looking very at your entire supplier relationship and seeing if components came from Xinjiang. And it doesn't matter if the export came from Malaysia, Vietnam to US rather than China. That's not the issue. They're very well up to speed on this whole transshipment kind of issue.
And a couple of years ago, I think it was, if memory serves, Vietnam even got in on it a little bit and started cracking down on some companies in Vietnam that were relabeling product as made in Vietnam, and yet they had not done any true value add or modification to that product, because Vietnam didn't want to be on the naughty list, right? They wanted to get ahead of it and try to make those changes. And I think I mentioned this already, but if not, or if I did, I'll mention it one more time. there's a variety of agencies in every country, not just in the US, that are interested in this, the issue of country of origin. So we may find, because we do country of origin like determinations for people sometimes, and you may find that, yes, the country of origin is New Zealand or Mexico or Vietnam because you've substantially changed the function of the product. But for another regulation, not, and that's for duties, for how the product is categorized when it's coming into the Europe or the United States for duty purposes, it's categorized as made in Mexico. And so Mexican, US trade agreements and duties apply. But for other purposes, other specific tariffs or restrictions or things like you mentioned, UFLPA, for those purposes, especially the United States, does not always calculate country of origin the same way by every agency. And the WTO has written, EU has written all kinds of findings saying they don't like how the US is doing this. They're not following WTO regulations on country of origin determination. They're not transparent about how their customs or these other agencies are applying COO regulations. So it is not a, it's not clear. It's not clear. It's not straightforward. So do not assume that that just because your country of origin determination for one set of regulations is Vietnam or Mexico or Australia or wherever, that it, that's going to keep you out of being covered by anti-dumping regulations on aluminum, for example, because your product may still have aluminum sourced from whatever country has the anti-dumping regulations in place. So you really need to understand fully your suppliers, sub-suppliers, and supply chain. So supply chain mapping has become even more important than it's ever been for companies and a hot topic of conversation. All right, everybody. I feel like we've, Art and I here have been fear-mongering. Be afraid, be afraid. And not any more afraid than you need to be anywhere. And frankly, if you're buying from manufacturers or selling, you know, export controls are a whole nother conversation, selling internationally or selling domestically in the EU or Europe, but with product that has been made overseas. You can also get caught on it, right? So you need to know. You need to know. Saying that you didn't know that it was your responsibility is not going to protect you. You need to do your research and you need to know.
But if you've been on the positive side, if you've been battle tested dealing with suppliers in China and dealing with China over the years and the intricacies of that, you know, at least the comforting thing we can say is that not a lot of this stuff is not going to be new to you, right? So so in that sense, you may, you know, the listeners may already have the experience for handling all these issues we just talked about.
You can apply those hard fought skills. So thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Again, this is Kim Kirkendall with International Trade Resources. You can find me on LinkedIn and the type of consulting work that we do. And my friend, Art Dicker.
Senior Counsel, R&P China Lawyers. And you can find me. I'm also, like Kim, very active on LinkedIn and happy for people to reach out.
All right, you guys. Thanks, Art. Good to talk to you. Hope everyone enjoyed the listen.
Okay. Thanks, Kim.
That's all for this episode of the International Trade Resource Podcast. We hope you found this discussion insightful and informative. To find more episodes and more information on all things international trade, check out our website at www.intltraderesources.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review on your favorite platform to help us spread the word. Join us next time for more exciting insights on the global marketplace. Until then, keep thinking globally.